You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In her latest book, Money Driven Medicine, financial journalist Maggie Mahar argues that over the past 25 years, power in our healthcare system has shifted from the physician to the corporation. And the effect, she says, has caused a healthcare crisis for over 48 million Americans. Her book is published by HarperCollins, and it brings Maggie Mahar to my show today. Welcome.
Hi.
So we talk about the medical profession, but are you saying that we should call it the medical industry?
I'm afraid so. Over the last 25 years, power has really shifted from the physician to the corporation, and that has created a built-in conflict of interest.
And what corporations are we talking about? Are these physician-based corporations?
We're talking about insurance companies, drug makers, device makers, and hospitals, including really not-for-profit hospitals that at this point in this marketplace are forced to play like and think of themselves as corporations.
And how has that affected the role of the physician who has now lost power?
The physician now finds himself sometimes in an adversarial position to not just insurance companies, but even hospitals. Rather than collaborating, all of the players are forced to compete because we have this money-driven, market-driven corporate system. And the thing about a corporation is that in the U.S., it is legally obliged to put its shareholders' interests first. It has to focus on making money, making profits.
Was the system working well when physicians held more power?
Yes and no. Certainly it was
working. Because I don't remember it as heavenly. In fact, probably all the problems that we have are the result of attempts to correct a situation that was far from good.
Certainly not perfect. What I would say, though, is that in the past, physicians really took seriously the notion that they were professionals. Most still do. But a professional, and this is the key thing, has to put his patient's interest ahead of his own financial interest. And I think most physicians then and now at least are trying to do that. A few at this point have become so cynical they say, look, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a businessman, it's a business. But when you look at hospitals that are run not by physicians but by MBAs, they're not obliged to put the patient's interest first. That's not how they think of themselves as professionals. They think of themselves as businessmen, and they're obliged to make profits for their shareholders.
Some people would like to see a Scandinavian or Canadian-style national health service here. But do you think that's likely?
It's becoming more likely, and it's sort of in an undercurrent way. When I was talking to doctors, so many would say to me, you know, I never thought I would say this, or my father was a physician. He would be rolling in his grave to hear me say this, but I think we've got to get the government involved. And there was a survey done by Indiana University not long ago. Almost half of all doctors wanted national health insurance.
But as you suggest, in the past, that wasn't the case. I remember when National Health Service was proposed during the Eisenhower administration. He called it creeping socialism, and the AMA was adamantly opposed. And then Medicaid was proposed later, and the AMA was strongly against it. So what's happened?
The AMA was against Medicare, and Medicare came into being really because Lyndon Johnson knew how to get legislation passed. And he said to his advisors, what do we have to pay them? And they were told that if you make Medicare fee-for-service, where doctors can charge whatever they want to and hospitals can charge whatever they want to and you pay them, then you'll get it through. And so he agreed to that, and they did.
And how well has that worked?
Well, what happened after that is that Medicare began to set fees for what they call diagnostic groups. For particular illnesses, they'll pay you a particular amount to cure that illness in an effort to curb spending. But what I would say is that today, first of all, the AMA no longer represents most doctors. And more doctors in more and more specialties are saying we need government involvement. And that's a shift. That's a shift even in the last 10 years.
Is the level of funding in the Medicare system the same across the country?
No, it's not. Because from the beginning, fees were set according to what's customary and usual in this particular geographic region. And that has been the basis, well, originally that was a basis for paying doctors and hospitals under Blue Cross Blue Shield. So private insurers essentially started that basis for paying. Medicare followed it. And so today, Medicare will pay far more, say, to a doctor in Manhattan than a doctor in Nebraska for the same procedure. Now, that makes some sense because in Manhattan, your overhead is higher in terms of renting office space. But not that much higher. In other words, there are a lot of distortions now in the payment.
So payments. Does that encourage more doctors to practice in Manhattan? An awful lot of doctors are saying they don't want to have anything to do with Medicare, whether it pays more or less.
Though the majority of doctors, even in Manhattan, do take Medicare. And talking to doctors, if you ask them how they like Medicare and how they like private insurers, hands down, almost all of them prefer Medicare. Because Medicare isn't trying to find a way to come up with a form that makes it difficult for them to get reimbursed. Medicare isn't playing games with them, and Medicare also isn't trying to micromanage care. They don't have to get on the phone with Medicare and get permission to do something. Medicare says, we cover this, gives them a long list of what it covers, and that's that.
My guest is Maggie Mahar, who has written Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. It is published by Collins, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. We've had any number of suggestions over the course of my lifetime. Richard Nixon came up with the healthcare system. He said that we face a massive crisis in this area, talking about healthcare. Later, of course, we had the Clinton plan. What happened with the Nixon plan? What were the problems he saw at that time?
Well, Nixon had a deal, really, in June of 1974. He had a deal with Ted Kennedy. An informal vote in Ways and Means suggested the plan was going to go through. It was a very generous plan for national health insurance, giving everyone the same level of care, including things like alcohol rehabilitation. But that was June of 1974. And, of course, what happened after that was Watergate. And the whole thing fell apart. Nixon wasn't going to get any major legislation through once Watergate happened. But we were very, very close. It's very interesting. And then in the early 90s, the Clintons came to Washington. I think we're really naive about Washington politics, how to get a bill through Congress. Put it this way, if Hillary Clinton had been married to Lyndon Johnson, entertain that notion for a minute, in the early 90s, I think that that bill probably would have gone through because he would have known how to get the votes in Congress.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they would have killed each other.
Well, this might be true, too.
but that was not that was a very complicated system. Would that have many people were relieved when it actually wasn't enacted, people who would like to seek some kind of national health care system?
It was a very complicated plan. One problem is that Ira Magaziner had convinced Clinton that he had to propose a plan with no tax increases. In terms of startup costs, there probably would have to be some tax increases. They came up with a several hundred page plan. Really, no one knew what was in it. It was hatched behind closed doors. That made it very easy for the insurance companies to move into that vacuum of ignorance and say, this is going to be terrible for you, and that's what they did. Now, the plan that people are talking about today, John Conyers has a plan in Congress, which is called Medicare for All. And quite simply is opening up Medicare to people under the age of 65, saying if you want to, you and your employer can buy an insurance policy for Medicare, get all the benefits that Medicare provides, and we can sell it to you for less than a private insurer would because our overhead is less.
But hasn't Medicare been declared on the verge of bankruptcy ever since I can remember? How would we expand it?
It would be no more expensive than it is now insofar as people under 65 and their employers will be paying for the cost of the coverage that they were getting. So it wouldn't be expanding the Medicare deficit. That's a separate problem that's really going to be addressed by Medicare beginning to ask questions about what it covers and the cost effectiveness of what it covers. For instance, Genentech has a cancer drug, costs $100,000 a year for this drug, and on average it lengthens your life by 5 months. Now, And oftentimes, the patient has a 20% copay, $20,000. Some patients have been saying it's not worth it. And probably Medicare needs to talk to a panel of doctors and patients and say, do we all want to be funding this, or would we rather put the money into something else, like palliative care for cancer patients?
But what would this expanded, has anybody looked at this expanded Medicare and what it would cost someone like me as opposed to my current plan, which keeps on going up and up and up?
People have run numbers, and basically Medicare would cost probably 15 to 20% less than private insurance. And the reason is that private insurers have to spend millions on advertising as they compete with each other, millions on lobbyists. Medicare doesn't need lobbyists in Washington. And then the administrative costs of enrolling people, disenrolling them, re-enrolling them as they move from one plan to another are huge. So for a private insurer to be as efficient as Medicare, it has to save 15 to 20% a year, and that's very, very hard to do.
Japan is not the least expensive country in the world, and yet we spend twice as much on health care as the Japanese, and they live longer than we do, don't they?
That's right. Now, maybe you can put some of that down to green tea and fish, but probably not all of it. Or put it this way, if we're spending twice as much, our health care system should be twice as good if money is what counts, and very few people would argue that our healthcare system is twice as good. So we're wasting a lot of money.
And we just heard that the English are healthier than we are. They have a national healthcare system, although that's been under attack recently. Can we attribute it to that or to the English eat?
Well, what we know is that we're fatter than they are, but they drink more than we do. So when you look at the lifestyle factors, it seems to be a wash. There's some argument that maybe our lives are more stressful. On the other hand, the UK is hardly a Polynesian island. So what I think we have to say is that we're spending 2.5 times as much. We're not getting the bang for our buck. Studies in medical journals recently suggest that 1 out of 3 healthcare dollars is wasted on unnecessary tests, unproven procedures, new overpriced drugs and devices that are no better than what they replaced.
And when was the turning point? You seem to suggest it was during the Reagan administration.
Well, 1980 was a real watershed. When the Reagan administration came in, they really felt that the market is the best solution to everything. And they said, look, Medicare costs are going up, healthcare costs are going up. That's because the healthcare system is run by doctors. Doctors are not businessmen. We've got to bring the discipline of the market to healthcare, and that's what they attempted to do. Previous to 1980, most HMOs or insurance companies that provided health care were not for profit because the government provided financial incentives to be not for profit. Reagan ended those incentives, and in the years that followed, most HMOs and health insurers were for profit. That changed things quite a bit.
88% were not for profit in 1981, 41% by 1986.
That's right. That's right.
And then some doctors start their own HMOs?
Some doctors started their own HMOs. Some were good. Some weren't so good. It was very hard for them to compete, though, with the big guns, the Aetnas, et cetera. For-profit hospitals also came into being in the 80s, again, with the notion that the market would be more efficient. When we look at the results in for-profit hospitals, we find that care is no better, and they tend to be more expensive.
And didn't the relationship between the pharmaceutical companies and doctors change around that time as well?
Yes, exactly. Pharmaceutical companies more and more. The arm's length relationship between researchers and universities and pharmaceutical companies began to break down. And more doctors and researchers and universities were doing research, handing it over to pharmaceutical companies, getting a cut. And this meant that what you research is driven by what will be most profitable. There's a saying in the pharmaceutical industry, a pill that cures is good, a pill you have to take every day is better. So if I'm a CEO of a pharmaceutical company, and my first obligation, again, is to my shareholders, if I'm going to develop a new drug, I have to develop the drug that is my marketers tell me is going to make the most money, whether or not that's the drug that society needs most.
As you pointed out earlier, with a drug that costs $100,000 a year and may extend life 5 months.
Exactly, exactly. And we have, in 2004, we had 400 cancer drugs in clinical trials. And oncologists said, you know, we can't keep track of this many drugs. We can't figure out whether to use them in sequence, together, individually. It's just too many. And many oncologists have said, if these drug makers, instead of competing, each of them shoving as many drugs as they can into their own pipeline, if they would collaborate, share their research, they could come out with fewer, more effective cancer drugs. We have a lot of drugs that shrink tumors, but there's no mortality benefit. You don't live longer. Your tumor shrinks, and then it comes back.
My guest is Maggie Mahar, whose previous book was Bull, A History of the Boom and Bust, 1982-2004. And now she's written Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. It is published by Collins, an imprint of HarperCollins. Stay with us for more. We're back with Maggie Mahar, whose latest book is Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. It's published by Collins, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. So how much is the average annual family premium for an HMO these days, or something that or some health plan that actually people are getting at their job?
Average is close to $11,000. And going
and that's
up.
With employees also contributing to
that's
it?
That's the total
employers?
Cost. If your employer doesn't cover you, that's the total cost to you. If your employer helps, and the two of you together are paying close to $11,000. And, you know, 5 years ago, 70% of employers offered health insurance. Now it's down to 60%, steep drop in a very short period of time.
Is that why rates seem to be climbing so fast?
No, rates are climbing so fast because the cost of drugs, devices, hospital stays are spiraling. And that really, a lot of the cost of hospitals is really the cost of the devices, the artificial knee, the drugs that you get in the hospital. That's technology is driving hospital costs to a very large degree. Also labor. Hospitals are labor intensive.
But the argument against a national health service of the sort that we see in Canada is that they won't give you those artificial knees and some of the other things because they don't consider them cost effective.
It's actually not true. You can get an artificial knee in
Canada.
Just
got to wait a long time?
You may have to wait a while. Some countries with national health insurance have no lines. For instance, Germany, Switzerland, some countries with national health insurance do have lines, like UK and Canada. Has a lot to do with how much they're spending. I mean, we spend twice as much as Canada, 2.5 times as much as the UK. If Canada spent, say, 20% more, they probably wouldn't have lines. Some of those lines, though, are not at all harmful. One interesting thing is that we hear a lot about how Canadians have to come here for health care because health care there is unavailable, etc. So a study was done by a U.S. journal called Health Affairs, and they interviewed hospitals and doctors close to the border near major population centers in Canada. They interviewed doctors specializing in areas where there are long lines in Canada. They interviewed the 100 best hospitals in the U.S., and what they found is a number of Canadians coming to the U.S. for health care, the numbers were barely discernible. Canadians who got health care here tended to be on vacation here and had an accident. They titled the study Phantoms in the Snow, but they said it'll be very hard to lay this myth to rest because it serves the interests of some very powerful interests, i.e. for-profit insurers and hospitals.
On the other hand, I've recently seen a number of reports on television, people in this country who need operations going to India or going to other Asian countries.
And it's interesting, people going to India, and oftentimes they're not going to save money, and they know that. By the time they pay for a flight and a friend to go with them and fly first class because you're not feeling well and it's a long trip, you stay in a hotel there, and in India you have a choice between very expensive hotels and hotels you don't want to stay in. They're not so much saving money, but what people say is they treated me so much better. The hospitals were so much nicer. Our hospitals have become quite chaotic. We're understaffed in terms of nurses. Canadians have more nurses per population than we do. And nurses are trying to do too many things. That's why one reason why we have so many errors in our hospital, many adverse events, they call them. Yeah.
But haven't I seen a number of ads for hospitals here that make them sound like they're kind of hotels that you get medical treatment in?
Yes, and that's one problem. Because our hospitals are competing in a marketplace for customers, for well-heeled, well-insured customers, when a hospital executive decides how to allocate his money, let's say he has a windfall, he's got $3 million to spend, well, should he invest in valet parking or should he invest in palliative care nurses and doctors who are trained to talk to, listen to, and consult with the dying and their families? Valet parking is going to bring in more customers. Most people won't know about the palliative care. They'll see the valet parking. A new heart center with the waterfalls is going to bring in well-heeled customers, but it doesn't improve health care in that hospital.
But aren't the well-heeled customers important for hospitals to offset the costs of the uninsured and the underinsured?
Exactly, and that's why hospitals increasingly, when they make decisions about how to allocate healthcare dollars, are saying to themselves, we need the profit margin first. Sure, we have a mission to serve our community, but no margin, no mission. So more and more the emphasis is on making this what's called the not-for-profit world, the surplus or the margin.
Do you have headphones there? Because if you do, could you put them on? We have a call from somebody who has some interesting points to make.
Okay, great.
Rashmi, is it?
Yeah.
From Long Island. Hi, Rashmi. You're on the air.
I'm a practicing surgeon right now, and I can tell you that the waste that goes on in terms of repetition of tests because of the poor quality of tests done at one particular place and then other, where I practice within 5 mile radius, we have about 20 places that do MRI. These have to be supported. And most of all, the patients' families, especially older patients, you tell them that the operation is, you know, may kill the person, this and that. But I feel that because they know they don't have to pay anything out of pocket, they say, no, we want the best for our parents or this and that. And I think if people were allowed to, asked to pay 5 or 10% of the bill, you will see very quickly how quickly they'll say, no, it's okay, my mother is very old, my father is old, they have lived a good life, etc. So I think the people's expectation is so unrealistic.
But, doctor,
marketplace is promotes all these testing. You do mammogram, they tell you to do MRI, they tell you to ultrasound and this and that. And we do it because if we don't do it, our malpractice insurance goes up.
Yeah, well, that's the other factor. First, you said that it's because people were insisting on it, but I've heard again and again that we're scheduled to take all of these tests, whether we want them or not, and take all sorts of drugs because they are a way of hospitals actually getting a little more money so that they, again, so that they could pay for all the people who cover the cost of all the people who can't pay. Is that true,
That's Megan? Right. A lot of it is the result of free market competition. What's good for business is more business. So what's good for hospitals is more tests. What's good for the people who sell the MRI units is more MRI units. Ideally, instead of competing, hospitals would be collaborating. So you wouldn't have 14 MRI units within a 20-mile radius. But right now, if one hospital gets a piece of equipment, other hospitals say, we better get it too so we can compete. Instead of getting together and saying, okay, you'll do the MRIs, we'll invest in this other thing and we'll do that. Once they all have the MRI units, the only way to pay for them is to use them. Now, in terms of consumers paying more out of pocket, it would seem that that would cut costs. But what happens, well, studies show that when consumers have to pay more out of pocket, 50% of the time, that leads them to curtail unnecessary care, which is good. 50% of the time, that causes them to curtail necessary care, which isn't good. The problem is, as consumers, we're not really in a good position to know what's necessary and what isn't because we haven't gone to med school and because medicine itself is very uncertain.
My guest is Maggie Mahar, M-A-H-A-R. Her book, Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason That Healthcare Costs So Much, is published by Collins, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. This is WNYC 93.9, MA20. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Vladimir Lopate. We've been talking about for-profit hospitals. When did most hospitals wind up being for-profit? Wasn't there a long period of time when most were not-for-profit?
The idea of a for-profit hospital was an oxymoron until the 80s. And in the 80s, there was enough money sloshing around in the healthcare system between insurers covering more and more things, Medicare come into being, and suddenly businessmen said, hey, you know, this is an industry where maybe we could make money. And also, some politicians felt that if hospitals were for-profit, they would be more efficient, that by definition, something that's for-profit is more efficient than what's not-for-profit. Turned out not to be true. Also turned out to be very hard to make money in hospital industry because it's labor-intensive. There's an economist called William Baumol who described what's called Baumol's disease, and that is in certain industries, specifically education and healthcare, if you downsize, reduce the number of workers, you're going to hurt the quality of the product. In many industries with advanced technology, they've been able to downsize, have fewer workers, and have just as good a product. However, in healthcare and education, put it this way, it's no easier for a teacher to teach 25 students or a nurse to care for 25 patients than it was 30 years ago. You can't downsize. If you do in hospitals, people die. For-profit hospitals have found that out. Yeah.
But we've been hearing that a lot of these hospitals have lots of empty beds. Is that because there aren't enough sick people to fill them, or not enough well-off sick people to fill them?
In some places, there are enough sick people to fill them. Our hospitals are not always in the right place. For-profit hospitals, and I should say they're only 15% of all hospitals, but they've defined the market in many ways. For-profit hospitals build a hospital where they think they can make money, not where a hospital is needed necessarily.
But you suggested earlier that the not-for-profit hospitals now are also affected by market forces.
Exactly. Partially because not-for-profit hospitals now are responsible to bondholders. There was a time in which not-for-profit hospitals got much more of their money from charities and from the government. Now they're largely dependent on the bond market. And as a bondholder, I'm interested in getting the return on my investment. I'm not as interested in whether or not that hospital is meeting the needs of its community. That's not my problem.
You talked about John Conyers' proposal to expand Medicare. What has Bill Frist, who is a doctor involved in a profit for-profit hospital system, isn't he?
He's the heir.
And a potential presidential candidate. What is he saying?
Bill Frist is the heir to the fortune that was built by HCA, the largest for-profit hospital network in the country. HCA has been in some real trouble in the past, cooking its books, keeping two sets of books, showing one to Medicare. Now, Senator Frist was not running the network at any point in time. He simply owns a lot of the stock. And it's interesting that not too long ago, about a year ago, it became apparent that HCA's stock was going to be in trouble, at least internally. Executives at HCA knew that their earnings were not going to be what they thought they were going to be. Frist sold all of his stock shortly before the stock tanked. That was a big story in the news, and then it just kind of disappeared. He was being investigated. Don't know what happened. Accusations that he was trading on insider information. One doesn't know, but certainly his timing was very convenient. Now, Frist has long supported for-profit hospitals. He supported the Medicare Modernization Act, which is a windfall for the insurance industry, for the pharmaceutical industry, for their lobbyists. So Frist has been on the side, basically, of for-profit health care, money-driven medicine from the outset.
Some local governments have gotten involved in this whole thing, haven't they? Is that part of the problem in America, that we can have health care that's affected by federal governments, state governments, and local governments?
It creates a very fragmented system. I mean, states like Massachusetts, for instance, have tried to move toward universal health insurance within their state. The problem with states can be good labs for experimenting, but the problem with state solutions is that we wind up with this fragmented healthcare system. What we really need is a unified healthcare system where hospitals, drug makers, everyone is collaborating, sharing research, sharing knowledge. And also we need healthcare IT. We need hospitals and doctors to be able to talk to each other electronically, share test results, share patients' records.
Right now they're in competition with each other?
They're in competition with each other. No one is invested in health IT. In most other countries, government has invested in health IT. So in most other countries, if you go into a doctor, he can call up your medical record on his computer and see what drugs another doctor has already prescribed for you.
Haven't there also been proposals to make the insurance companies a bit more responsive to the people they're denying payment for? I know everybody has an experience of calling up an insurance company and getting a runaround.
That's
right.
And
then going on for months and months, giving up a lot of their time, and eventually either giving up or just ending in frustration.
Yeah, and both patients and doctors spend a lot of time trying to get reimbursed from insurance companies. That's one reason why most doctors, I would say, prefer Medicare to private insurance companies.
And some won't even take insurance from some companies.
Yeah, and some insurance companies don't cover things that they should. Some insurance companies cover things that really aren't in our interests, but if the customer wants it, the insurance company will cover it. Vioxx is a good example. For-profit insurers continue to cover Vioxx. Not-for-profit insurers like Kaiser Permanente, like the VA, like the Mayo Clinic, all stopped covering Vioxx about 2 years before Merck withdrew it from the market because they knew that the benefits did not outweigh the risks. However, a for-profit insurer, say Oxford, wouldn't want to stop covering Vioxx because they might lose market share because a lot of people thought that it was a good drug. They weren't doctors. They didn't know the research. And basically, the for-profit insurer is going to cover what is going to give him the biggest market share, not necessarily what's better for your health.
Is healthcare a right or a personal responsibility?
Well, that's really cuts to the heart of the debate. If you think that it's a right, then you probably think we need national health insurance. If you think that it's a privilege, then you really feel every man for himself. The problem with every man for himself, there are ethical problems with that point of view. There's also an economic problem with that point of view. Even if you think everyone should take care of himself, the fact of the matter is, once a diabetic gets to the point where he has to have his foot amputated, we're all going to pay for it, one way or another. Higher insurance premiums, higher Medicare taxes.
Your last book was about the inefficiency of the stock market, now the inefficiency of our healthcare system. Any other inefficiencies out there?
Well, the market is not totally efficient, and I've covered Wall Street for many, many years. And, you know, in this book even about healthcare, I went to Wall Street analysts, some of the very smart, very honest ones, and better than anyone else, Wall Street knows that the market is A, not always efficient, and B, not always honest. And so probably Wall Street is a little more cynical, and rightly so, about the notion of corporations being efficient, because Wall Street knows about companies like Enron, and it knows that Enron is, alas, too typical.
But we are more likely to trust corporations involved in healthcare, and maybe we should be a bit more cynical there as well.
Yeah, I think we need to be skeptical.
Maggie Mahar's book, Money Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much, is published by Collins, an imprint of HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.